Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and tonight's conversation is with Dick Calder, Deputy Director for Administration for the CIA. And joining me is Ian Littman, also a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Ian?
Dick, let's spend some time talking about your current experience in reinventing the CIA. Before you took your present position in the Directorate of Administration, the Washington Post reported that you'd spent a lot of time criticizing it. What motivated you to take your present position, and what did you want to change within the directorate?
Ian, before I answer, I don't want to misrepresent myself. I'm not really trying to reinvent the CIA. It really is the Directorate of Administration over which I have responsibility. The Post did, I think, accurately capture what I said, but I want to really clarify that I wasn't criticizing the people in the directorate. It was really the bureaucracy that we have to deal with. As someone who had to travel often, as someone who had to deal with a series of regulations, often in environments where the regulations didn't quite apply, it was always that battle back and forth about how do you fix this or how do you make it work here, and that was always a little bit frustrating for me. So that was the criticism. And as I came into the job, I said, how can we make ourselves much more responsive? How can we take people who are imprisoned in this hierarchy that they work in and make them understand better what our customers need from us and therefore be able to shape and formulate policies that made the most sense to the people that were really dependent on us? And I think that in general, I've read several articles of late that talk about sort of the death of bureaucracy, people trying to move out of this command and control hierarchy of, you know, trying to restore some authority down into the ranks. And that was really what I was looking to do. Instead of having a series of policies and procedures that force things to march up through the organization to try to restore the people who really worked the front lines and understood the issues, to give them the authority and the capability to take care of problems on their own. That's what I was looking to do.
We note that one of your first actions was to perform an activity-based costing study. So I'm wondering, for those of us at home, if you could explain what that is and how you used it to drive your change initiatives.
Yeah, very, very simply, activity-based costing helped us to understand the cost of our processes. I think that one of the biggest problems with government is the free goods syndrome. We could talk a lot about this, but you know, basically, I don't think any of us can get enough of a free good. And the administrative processes that we do, the services that we provide, were basically free to our customers. And what I was trying to do was begin to understand what those processes, what those services cost, so that we could understand how better to deliver them. We could do some benchmarking outside. For example, we learned very early on that a corporation, I guess I can mention the name, Hewlett-Packard, has a very low transaction cost for some of the vouchering that they do, when compared to ours, significantly lower. And it was only by beginning to understand the individual or incremental process costs that we were looking at that we could begin to see how we might do ours differently. So we needed to know those costs in order to drive some different behaviors within the organization.
Dick, as we all know, organizational transformation can be very difficult. What have you learned about changing large organizations?
Not enough. I would say Machiavelli says that change has no constituency. And I don't know when he said that, obviously many, many years ago, and I think that's very, very true through today. We all, you know, change is great as long as it's happening to somebody else. And I think that what I have learned is one thing is that change is not, it's never an event, it's a process. And it's a process that takes some time to get through. What I found was that many of the things we were doing were more or less on autopilot. We had done them so well for so many years that the idea of thinking of doing them even slightly different was an anathema to some of our people. What we had to do was to try to, you know, get people to reframe issues, get people to reframe problems, get people to think differently about what they were doing. The biggest problem that I see in the government right now, though, is that we really do favor incremental change. And I remember Nicholas Negroponte wrote the book Being Digital. I think he argues that incrementalism is the worst enemy of innovation. Now, there's a reason for this. Incrementalism limits the downside. But incrementalism also doesn't get you to where you really want to be. It makes change, I think, sometimes much more difficult, and it makes you set a, makes you have to settle for a solution that is probably less than where you really want to be. I don't know how we can, you know, I've had some luck in trying to push beyond the incremental change, but this seems to be the preferred road, and this is going to make change, I think, in the government more difficult down the road, particularly as we have to deal with external changes that are even more different, more demanding than we face today.
And one of the things we noticed was that a major part of your strategy was to create an internal market for administrative services. Could you tell us more about this, as what it is and how it works?
Yeah, basically, this is complicated, but let me just say this. What we did was take the money that was appropriated to our components after they had written a business plan, after we were satisfied, and after we had approval from our executive board, take the money that was given to those components to do their services and return all of that money back to the customers. In other words, the customers now would have an opportunity to spend some, all, or none of those resources on us as providers. They could go to alternative providers. They could go to they could spend less for a certain service or for a certain good, but they had the option. And the reason here is we were looking at two behavioral changes. One, the incentive on us was now to deliver our services, our goods, much more effectively, much more smartly, much more competitively than we had in the past. So this forced us to look at our processes. It forced us to look at really trying to understand what our customers wanted. It also had the effect of changing the behavior of our customers, because now that our customers had the opportunity to understand cost-benefit analysis, the opportunity to make decisions and have an actual incentive for making a smarter decision, they chose to do the kinds of things that made the most sense for them, and could use the savings, if there were savings, could use those savings to be driven back to mission.
And did it change behavior?
It did in many, many cases. We found that a lot of our customers stopped doing some things. For example, we recently put telephones into this environment. And we found that we had a reduction of around 8% in usage of telephone lines. People just gave up telephone lines. We had people now going back trying to figure out how many cell phones they had, how many beepers they had. So it did drive changes. It did drive people to focus on this, primarily because they would benefit from making a smarter decision.
Great. It's time for a break. We'll be right back with more of the Business of Government Hour.